RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Welcome to our digital future on Reality Check Radio. My name is Alistair Harding, and today we're talking about CBDCs, and in particular, our New Zealand version that the Reserve Bank is currently researching, with the view to launching sometime in 2030 or beyond. A CBDC is a form of currency issued by a central bank, in this case, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. Currently, we have two forms of currency. One is the physical cash that you carry in your wallet, which is produced and backed by the Reserve Bank, which makes it a central bank currency. And the other is digital money, backed by your bank's capital reserves and assets. A CBDC, on the face of it, doesn't seem much different to the digital money we all already have. But the real difference here is that the CBDC is backed by a central bank, and the theory goes it will be much more convenient to use because transferring it from my account to yours, it will simply need to go direct via the central bank instead of between multiple banks. And thus, the main argument for CBDCs goes it will be faster and a better system for everyone. But also there's another reason central banks are interested in this. It's because all over the world right now, central banks are fighting for relevancy in a world where cryptocurrencies, stablecoins, and a multitude of other payment methods are flourishing. This from CNBC.
Many central banks are worried that the widespread adoption of independent cryptocurrencies could weaken their control over the financial system. This could cause financial instability, especially because cryptocurrencies do not have the legal or the regulatory safeguards that central bank money does. So why not issue a digital currency of their own?
But then there are concerns as well that many around the world, including New Zealanders, are worried about. And chief among those are the questions, will CBDCs be programmable? And by digitizing our money, will we get trapped in a digital prison where every transaction is available for governments to see and inspect and perhaps even force behaviors with? And this isn't just a conspiracy theory talked about in the dark corners of the dark web. Even US state governors like Ron DeSantis can see the dangerous potential of them.
So what the central bank digital currency is all about is surveilling Americans and controlling behavior of Americans. And how do we know? Because we've seen this happen in other parts of the world.
It's heady stuff and an issue you'd think would be being discussed at great length by the corporate media, but it's not. Which is strange because the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is not alone in investigating the issue of a CBDC. In fact, all around the world, three countries have already launched a CBDC: Nigeria, the Bahamas, and Jamaica. Also, 36 are at pilot stage, including Australia, 30 are in development, including the USA, Canada, and the UK, and 45 are researching CBDCs, including New Zealand. That's 124 countries working in one way or another on their own CBDC, and only 19 countries that have either deactivated or cancelled their CBDC planning. And so in the vacuum left by the corporate media, that's the story we're embarking on here today on Reality Check Radio. And over the next few weeks, we'll be discussing CBDCs, their benefits, and their potential negative outcomes. So come July 26, when the current Reserve Bank CBDC submission period ends, you too will be able to make an informed submission. And to begin that conversation, I started by talking with Michael Riddell, who spent over 30 years doing economic analysis and policy advice for the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, as well as other international banking organizations like the International Monetary Fund and the Reserve Banks of Papua New Guinea and Zambia. And my first question for him was, what does he think of the process the Reserve Bank has embarked on? Okay, welcome Michael Riddell to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
So in September 2021, the Reserve Bank put out an issues paper on the subject of CBDCs. It invited submissions from the public by December of that year, and those submissions ended up in a summary of responses paper that came out in April 2022. And you put in one of the submissions that is in there. There were over 6,800 submissions they received. And I've read your submission. You say that the case for a CBDC has not been persuasively made. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, my view all along and continues to be that it's a solution in search of a problem. You know, some people have argued for a CBDC as a substitute for cash, but the Reserve Bank's been quite clear that they're not trying to get rid of physical cash. It's certainly true that it's a bit harder to get cash these days, not so much in the cities, but if you're out in remote areas, it can be harder. But they argue, for example, a case on financial inclusion. People don't have bank accounts. But actually in New Zealand, if you get a welfare benefit, it's got to be paid to a bank account. We don't have the problem that they have in the US, for example, where a reasonable number of people, it might only be 2 or 3% of the population, just can't get a bank account. The private sector is already doing it. And so it's sort of not obvious to me why anyone would want to hold a central bank digital currency. And that's part of the relevance of what I was saying earlier. Prior to the Reserve Bank being set up, people happily held private bank banknotes. They were outlawed, so we had to use central bank banknotes. Most of our transactions we do holding the liabilities of private banks. We trust them. They're pretty well regulated. They have high levels of capital. There is just no obvious need for this product. But, you know, it's something that central banks around the world have been looking at. I guess it makes sense to look at it. If it had been me, I probably would have closed down the work well before now.
The way I read a lot of the information that the Reserve Bank's putting out, it seems to me that you may be right. There isn't the greatest case for it so far. But perhaps what they're doing is simply trying to remain relevant. Would that be an argument for CBDCs, that in a world where cryptocurrencies and stable coins and all of these other forms of money are starting to flood the global market, perhaps to stay relevant and to protect our sovereignty in New Zealand, we actually need something like a CBDC to underline that?
Yeah, I don't think that's true for two reasons. And you're right, those are the arguments they mount. I mean, one of those reasons is just that things like crypto and stable coins haven't really taken off as a large-scale payments medium. They operate at the margin. The pure crypto assets are very volatile in terms of price. You know, you look at a chart of the Bitcoin price, for example. But also, I think what will tend to happen if those do tend to become more widely used is that there will be a lot more government regulation of them. So a lot of the argument for crypto has been on privacy grounds, but we know that governments are very keen on their AML and CFT, countering financing of terrorism restrictions. Those will be brought to bear on crypto assets if they come to be widely used. But a more important argument is that in the end, where the Reserve Bank's leverage arises and its ability to control the price level in New Zealand, it isn't from issuing physical currency. It's from issuing the settlement cash balances, the bank accounts that banks hold at the Reserve Bank. And so the way the OCR works in New Zealand is that that's the interest rate that the Reserve Bank pays to the banks. And while the banks transact, while we actually transact primarily in New Zealand dollars, banks need to hold New Zealand dollars. The only issuer of New Zealand dollars is the Reserve Bank. So, you know, we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years when the OCR has been driven up very, very substantially, there's been no doubt at all about the leverage that the Reserve Bank has. And that's been true of central banks around the world. The argument about a potential loss of monetary sovereignty, it just isn't there. It's an abstract theoretical way. But what we've seen in so many countries around the world is that even when you get quite high inflation, you know, you had countries, I worked in Zambia, for example, we had inflation of 300% for a while. Still, most transactions continued to be done in the local currency. It takes a lot of some really bad shocks to displace people from pricing their labor, pricing their goods, pricing their houses, pricing their taxes in that local currency. And there's nothing to suggest that that's under threat at the moment, even though the use of physical Reserve Bank notes is steadily declining.
So would you just not, if it was up to you, you would just not introduce a CBDC at this point?
And in fairness to the Reserve Bank, they have not decided to introduce one. You know, they've got another consultative document out at the moment. There's hundreds of pages of consultants' reports and all of those sorts of things. And for them, there's still, I think, umming and ahhing about sort of how strong the use case is. I think they will be quite influenced there by what goes on in other countries as well, that if, as I suspect, other countries are quite slow to introduce anything in this area, I'll be a little bit surprised if our Reserve Bank rushes ahead. I suspect part of what they're doing is they're wanting to be positioned if other countries do move. But yes, I mean, if it was me, from what I can see at the moment, I would be closing the work down. If I was the Minister of Finance or the Reserve Bank Board, I would be asking very hard questions about how much money is being spent on this project for what conceivable benefit. There's no cost-benefit analysis being provided at all yet as to how this is actually going to be net beneficial and not just displace private sector innovation. You know, one of the things we know about the private sector is that it's a more reliable vehicle of innovation over time than monopolistic government agencies are. So, you know, you could envisage a hypothetical in which the Reserve Bank here set up a CBDC. One of their challenges would be to maintain their technology in a robust basis over decades to come. And because it's a monopoly provider, you then don't have any of the competitive discipline that comes from, say, private sector payment-to-payment apps that have been set up. I mean, Venmo is one that operates in the US. It doesn't operate here, but seems to operate very effectively as a peer-to-peer payments mechanism. You'd expect that sort of innovation to be developing and to continue to develop in the private sector here in New Zealand. The Reserve Bank risks displacing that.
Okay, so what you're talking about there is perhaps the Reserve Bank is just wanting to keep control over the money system, and that's why they see the need for this.
It's hard to tell what's driving them. I mean, clearly they do want to keep control over monetary policy. As I argued earlier, I don't think that's under threat. The ability to issue the OCR, the fact all our mortgages, our deposits are all denominated in New Zealand dollars, gives the Reserve Bank a considerable amount of leverage. The fact that physical currency is in relative decline and has been for decades is a real phenomenon, but it doesn't seem to pose a credible threat to the ability of central banks to manage money in their own economy, so long as their own economy more broadly is reasonably competently managed.
Okay, one of the biggest concerns that I know that a lot of our listeners at Reality Check Radio have is the issue of programmability for CBDCs. It seems to be an inherent part of a CBDC to be able to program it. For instance, they could put an expiry date on the money to drive economic growth. And that isn't being discussed by any of the papers that I'm seeing from the RBNZ. And it's a huge negative that people see for CBDCs. It's one of the biggest fears. Does the issue of programmability concern you? And why isn't it being discussed openly?
It doesn't unduly, because one of the lines that I run in respect of CBDCs is that many of the things that people worry about, and I think they're reasonable things to worry about as an extreme tail risk, could be done with the existing banking system without undue difficulty. So people worry, I mean, programmability. If you wanted to take things to the extreme, the government could ram legislation through Parliament tomorrow that said that every deposit in every regulated bank would expire in 3 years' time. Are they likely to do so? No. And is the Reserve Bank likely to do so? Also no. And for similar reasons. I mean, if they were to do so, it would deeply undermine any confidence in their asset. And, you know, you come back to my point earlier. If this were a proposal to abolish physical currency and insist that people had to transact with CBDCs, then I think people would have more grounds to be worried. But the Reserve Bank are quite adamant, and I don't disbelieve them, that they want whatever they introduce, if they introduce it, to be complementary to physical currency, complementary to commercial bank accounts. So, you know, we look around and we look at really abusive governments. You know, the Chinese run their social credit system. They managed to introduce their social credit system using the financial system as a way of exerting control without a CBDC. You can do a lot of bad stuff. People often highlight what Justin Trudeau did in Canada around those protesters at the time of during COVID. It was all done within powers with the existing banking system.
It would have been a lot easier for him, though, if he'd had a CBDC to deal with and programmability functions, wouldn't it? Would it not?
Potentially, but it would depend on the existing legal infrastructure around a CBDC. I mean, I think, again, to take the Reserve Bank at face value, and I think, you know, reasonably enough, if they introduce something, it will be introduced at considerable arm's length from the government of the day. Now, can governments legislate to override the central bank? Yes, they can. But I think what you're talking about is a pretty incremental risk relative to the wider risk of a government going down the path of tyranny. An awful lot could be done with existing technology, as we've seen in so many other countries around the world.
Okay. What does a CBDC mean for our banking system as it is? If the CBDC is launched as planned in 2030, like the RBNZ is talking about, it'll provide a way for New Zealanders to live outside the current banking ecosystem. What does that mean for banks in New Zealand? What does that mean for their future?
It's a big unknown, and it comes back to the point I was making earlier. I'm not convinced that many people will actually want to hold a CBDC. There will probably be a few people who really don't trust banks, who maybe at the moment prefer to hold physical banknotes just because they don't trust, not because they're criminals. And those people might find it convenient to be able to have an electronic form of central bank liability. But, you know, a good illustration of why I don't think there'll be much demand for it is that the government issues government bonds, and it has a specific form of government bonds that are targeted at retail investors, Kiwi bonds, and hardly anyone buys Kiwi bonds. One of the reasons why is they pay a bit lower interest rate than bank deposits do. People en masse don't distrust banks that much. They don't like banks, of course, but they don't think their money's going to disappear. So count me sceptical. Now, in their latest consultation paper, the Reserve Bank has a scenario in which I think it's something like 20% of bank deposits are replaced by central bank digital currencies. If that happened, there are big ramifications because then the banks are less able to be private sector credit providers, and the Reserve Bank has to decide what it's going to do with the liabilities that it's assumed. People put money with the Reserve Bank, it has to invest that money somewhere. At the moment, the Reserve Bank balance sheet tends to be made up of government securities and a few foreign assets, foreign reserves. Typically, central bank balance sheets are quite small. If they become large, then the Reserve Bank risks becoming an entity that's making decisions about the allocation of credit within our economy. And that's not, I think, something that most of us would want. I think it's not something that they would be terribly comfortable with either. But I think that's a very low probability, because why would people shift to this product, which really will only offer transactions balance services? Transactions balances aren't a large chunk of the balance sheet of banks, and they won't be offering bundled products. So a lot of us, we have our check accounts with a bank that might have provided us with a housing mortgage or might have provided term deposits as well. It's convenient to have all those services with one entity. There's no suggestion that the Reserve Bank is going to be offering that rich range of products. So it just sort of reinforces my scepticism about the likely demand.
Okay, one thing that I notice when I read through the issues paper and also the responses to the issues paper is that stewardship is a huge part of all of this discussion. From reading the response paper, it appears that the Reserve Bank's putting a lot of energy into framing itself as the natural operator of a CBDC in this country, which I suppose is expected. And likewise around the world, I also read about organizations like the IMF and SWIFT and the Bank of International Settlements also sort of jockeying for positions to be the transactions handler for CBDCs all around the world on a global scale. And there's huge amounts of power that these positions potentially hold. They'll oversee every transaction of CBDCs, whether it's the Reserve Bank being the controller and the administrator here in this country, or those other international organizations I mentioned being the international settlements provider. First of all, how powerful will these positions actually be in the end? And what dangers to democracy and actual freedom do they hold? What sort of unforeseen outcomes do we need to be aware of when we're thinking about that? Because what we're doing is we're building organizations with huge amounts of power over the population of the world, basically.
I think, again, the question comes back to how widely are these things likely to be used? How much demand is there likely to be? If you're as skeptical about that as I am, then you tend not to be very worried about those sorts of risks. I mean, the bulk of transactions that are made in any payment system within a country. The people you transact with most are the people who live within 5 kilometres of you, you know, your local supermarket or other sorts of utility providers. So, I mean, I'm not unduly worried about those sorts of entities. You know, I used to sit on the board of the International Monetary Fund as the New Zealand representative there. IMF's made up of a bunch of well-meaning people, but, you know, it's an intensely political organisation. It can't do anything very fast. It doesn't actually wield any independent power itself. So, you know, genuinely, I don't think that's one of those things to be worried about. It's one of those things to watch as the design features go through as to sort of, you know, what powers are handed over. But, you know, probably people should be more worried about the accountability of our own Reserve Bank, because that's where most of the payments arise. And that's where there have been some real questions in the last 5 or 10 years, you know, a powerful independent agency, just how accountable to Parliament and to the public effectively is it?
So the last question I have for you is, have you got any advice for our listeners? What is the one thing you'd like them to know about CBDCs that they should be putting in their submissions when submissions close on July 26?
It's an interesting question. One of the things that may be most valuable to them is a sense from people as to how they think they might or might not use an instrument like this. You know, if the Reserve Bank hears from a lot of people that they're going, hey, this is something I've been looking for many years, I'm really keen on this, or if they hear from other people going, look, I just can't understand who'd want to hold this. Those, I think, are perhaps some of the most valuable sorts of feedback. Now, it's true that none of us can tell until a product's actually launched how much we will or won't use it. But, I mean, I think a lot of the issues that the Reserve Bank, that people are worried about, those ones around privacy and all those sorts of things, are real and important issues. But they're also ones that the Reserve Bank's very conscious of already. But I think sort of in those areas are probably the main things that are worth submitting on for the ordinary man or woman in the street.
Cool. Hey, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it, your insight into this subject.
Good. Pleasure.
And so that was Michael Riddell, and you can read more of what he has to say on this topic of CBDCs and more at his finance blog, which can be found at www.croakingcassandra.com. That's www.croakingcassandra.com. But if Michael Riddell's view was that the case just doesn't exist for CBDCs, there's another view out there currently as well, that regular RCR contributor Jody Brunning, who represents physicians and scientists for global responsibility, says they won't just go away because there's no demand. Rather, they have inherent dangers to our democracy, which means they need to be resisted at least for a few years while we gauge the success and failures of other CBDC programs around the world. Okay, so Jody, thanks for joining me today. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you for inviting me on behalf of PSGA.
Okay, so we've just heard from Michael Riddell, someone who's worked at the Reserve Bank and also central banks in Papua New Guinea and Zambia. And he's also been on the board of the IMF. And his message is that he doesn't see the required demand for a CBDC in New Zealand, that it will just simply, in his words, wither on the vine. You work with physicians and scientists for global responsibility, and you've just put out a rather lengthy paper on the subject of CBDCs. So my first question is, why are physicians and scientists for global responsibility interested in this subject? If someone as experienced as Michael Riddell is not concerned about it, why are you?
Alistair, thank you for that question. We're really concerned about this subject because CBDCs aren't a technology that will be used in isolation. So for a long time, our PSGR have been looking at technology and how it works. And you have, for example, you have a pesticide and it's a formulation, and all the ingredients in the formulation are what make that pesticide more powerful. And CBDCs are a little bit like that. So they will be interoperable. Now, this is a term that everyone is using all the fintech industry, the finance and technology industries, the Bank of International Settlements, the IMF, all the NGOs that are representing stakeholders such as the World Economic Forum. They all understand that the power of this technology is its interoperable potential, and particularly because it's going to be coupled to digital identities. So a digital identity is not just your driver's license in this digital world. It's your digital identity that involves you acquiescing to a photograph, and that photograph will include an iris scan so that your biometric data is used. So this is why CBDCs are very powerful. And I'm very, very happy that Michael Riedel thinks it's a non-starter, and I really hope he's right.
Well, all of that sounds rather scary. What's the argument for a CBDC? We've heard that this is simply a case of central banks trying to stay relevant in a world where there are a multitude of payment options. Is this just a case of the Reserve Bank trying to stay relevant?
Yes, well, it's a little bit of a misnomer, really. It's a little bit misleading because the RBNZ have a massive role. They're our financial markets regulator. They're responsible for monetary policy, for oversight of the financial system and prudential regulation of banks, you know, the deposit takers, insurance companies. So when they say that they're staying relevant, this is because they're talking about a tiny aspect of what they do, which is monetary policy. So today they release hard cash, and you know, we believe they should continue releasing hard cash. Now, them saying that this reason is such an important reason is included along with that there'll be controlled access. You know, they claim that there'll be controlled access to central bank currencies, and that this will be resilience. It will be seen as another payment method, which is, well, you know, there's plenty of retail banks out there that can do this, that it will lead to payments diversity, so another, you know, competitor, and, you know, promoting financial inclusion. Well, this can be done by the government through the appropriations process, that it will speed up cross-border payments, all these sort of reasons or sort of excuses, many of them can be undertaken by existing retail banks or by the government through the appropriations process. So the claims are really, really, dare I say, silly. If you compare the claims, I think they're overstating the importance of that when you think about their existing responsibilities as financial markets regulator.
Okay, well, let's talk about risks. What risks do you foresee in a CBDC? We're talking about privacy and sovereignty and all of those things, aren't we?
Yes, Alistair, there's four major ones and another two that possibly also are major ones as well. So digital IDs will be coupled to CBDCs. You know, you can't have a CBDC without a digital ID. And that enhances all of government oversight over private activity. So this is from the DIA, the Department of Internal Affairs, that holds your digital ID information. But it could also move through, you know, social welfare, the health department, criminal justice system. And so we know that there's information sharing agreements. So we know this is a real problem that could be weaponized or harnessed at scale by this technology. The second one is that CBDCs will be transferred electronically using pre-programmable smart contracts. So these smart contracts can also be composable. They can be many smart contracts can be operated together. And a smart contract is a self-executing, you know, application, and that, you know, so they can even be involved third-party sort of contracts and third-party directions now. So someone can tell someone that can tell someone that can tell you to do something. So what we're seeing is this happening in a quiet place, in a quiet, dark, bureaucratic place, and how do you ever chase it up if there's an abuse of power or something goes wrong? So the third one is the potential for erosion of parliamentary oversight. So, you know, the RBNZ is accountable to our sovereign democratic New Zealand parliament. But if they have the power to release their own retail digital cash, as they call it, their CBDCs, that will actually, they will claim to use that for a lot of processes that we actually would already use our government parliamentary appropriations process for. So we would see, I believe, a devolvement of power to the RBNZ by this. And of course, they're not elected. They're bureaucrats that are sitting in offices. So, and the fourth one is the continued increase in oversight and delegation of the production of strategy, policy and rules to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the Bank of International Settlements, the BIS. And so these powerful agencies have been leading policy development on CBDCs, in addition to and at many forums where they cross over with the fintech industry, including the big management consultancies. So they, what happens is the BIS will do all this work to develop policy. They will develop, inverted commas, best practice. They will develop principles. They will make sure that all the central banks harmonise. And by doing that, they sort of corral the central banks into adopting the priorities and principles of the BIS rather than holding on and protecting the way those central bankers think, those New Zealand central bankers think, that is like democratic. So what is the best for New Zealand? Mm. Because they start to think like the BIS, and that's a problem.
Okay, so a lot of these things that you're talking about, they're questions about trust. For instance, you know, do we trust the Reserve Bank and the New Zealand government not to use the CBDC to incentivize behavior? Michael Riddell, in our previous interview, he said that it's actually in the government's and the Reserve Bank's interest to safeguard against these concerns about trust. Otherwise, if people don't trust the CBDC, they simply won't use it. And that's a really key point. I mean, that's the key point of any money system anywhere in the world, that it's all based on trust. Now, you've got a whole chapter about trust in your paper for PSGR. What's your view on trust in all of this?
So our view is trust is massively, massively important in this role. And so you could look at trust from, for example, Accenture and KPMG and the World Economic Forum's perspective, where they say digital trust is individuals' expectation that digital technologies and services and the organisations providing them will protect all stakeholders' interests and uphold societal expectations and values. So that's the corporate position. And probably that's the position, unfortunately, of the RBNZ, because they've tended, and this is a big theme of our paper, is that the RBNZ have adopted the rhetoric and the language of this Bank of International Settlements, the Central Bank's Bank, and the FinTech corporations. But if we start looking at what is trust in a democracy, so, you know, when we look at trust, you know, the rule of law, the parliamentary process, the process where, you know, the appropriations and the budgetary process can be debated, all these functions of government, the theoretical separation of powers between the government agencies, the parliament and the judiciary, these are all parts of how we trust that the government will put our best interests first. The fact that, you know, that there are principles that are known as constitutional and principles that mean that, you know, the government's, you know, actors and the staff, the elected members have to, you know, act in our best interests. So trust involves how do we look at the long-term game and what happens when there is enormous power held. So this is why we actually talk about fiduciary responsibility. When there is an uneven mismatch in powers, there is an onus on the powerful institution to look to the interests of that person, that individual. And let's highlight the individual, because if we cannot protect the individual, we cannot protect groups of individuals. So trust is really important.
Okay, and also on that topic is the subject of stewardship. It's a big part of the Reserve Bank discussion papers that have been put out already on this topic for a New Zealand CBDC. I asked this of Michael Riddell, and I'll ask you as well. By centralising the power to oversee our money system, both at a domestic level with the Reserve Bank and also at the international level where settlements providers will be established to oversee all of this data that CBDCs will produce, how powerful are these organizations we'll be building? And what are the dangers to democracy in all of this that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, this is the issue, they are powerful and there is a danger to democracy. And one thing I sort of didn't quite emphasise enough when I was talking about trust is remember how powerful the RBNZ already is, you know, because also most people in New Zealand don't know they've just gone through an extensive transformation process following advice from the IMF in 2016, 2017 that has increased their powers of oversight. And so they have to regulate the financial market. So if they then start taking other powers, then, you know, so this means that how can we actually trust them? Because their role becomes even more political. And so the art of controlling reserve banks, central banks, has been by preventing their political powers and keeping their political powers that are inherently social, cultural and economic and environmental with the people. So you want to keep them constrained because they're a bank. They print money, basically. So there is no doubt that these big, powerful institutions will be able to take power, and they become operating like a consortium, I guess the word is, and Whitney Webb's used this in the past too, because they are operating at such high levels, they're oligopolies, and because both government central banks and the Bank of International Settlements are too big to fail, they actually can't fail. And when we look at the Bank of International Settlements, it's not only too big to fail, it's indemnified. It's got all these provisions that mean they've got absolute secrecy and absolute power, and there's the Bank of International Settlement staff. They are also indemnified too. So this is a very frightening situation where if we delegate our power to them, if we trust them to come up with all the best practice arrangements and all the harmonisation protocols. And then, Alistair, what we haven't talked about is once you have what's called the Bank of International Settlements calls a unified ledger, once all the central banks, and there's an image, and I've posted this on all our social media today, and it shows that the central banks, there's lots of cubes on a round circle that are connected, and they're connected by what's called a unified ledger. And the APIs, the smart contracts go onto that unified ledger and bang, it's happening across all of the central banks. And the Bank of International Settlements is the central bank's bank. So that's how power will be conferred.
So what you're saying is that whenever a CBDC is spent anywhere in the world, that it goes onto a ledger and it is ultimately controlled by the international global ledger operator. In your example, you were discussing perhaps it might be the BIS, but it could be any number of organizations that are jockeying for that position right now.
So when you say controlled, the BIS, for example, would control the rules and guidelines. But we need to, Jonathan Boston, Boston Bagnall and Barry have written a paper in 2019 which talks about foresight and looking forward and understanding where the risks might arise in the future. And so we need to be skeptical and critical about the taking of powers or how these powers can be taken over the long term. And so what we could anticipate is that the powers that could be taken through a crisis could be so extraordinary that it's really right now hard to imagine But we cannot underestimate the perhaps the desire by large institutions to consolidate power. So we need to not cast this stuff aside and say, oh, no, that's a bit silly. They're being a bit silly talking about that.
Okay. Let's go back to your paper. Your paper provides four recommendations on CBDCs. Can you take us through them? What are you recommending here?
Okay, so we recommend, so the Reserve Bank of New Zealand has said that they're just going to do some protocols and trials in the next, say, 3 or 4 years, and then they'll put in a CBDC after 2030. But we are very clear, we believe that a minimum, so we've had members of PSGR arguing for a longer period. We, at a minimum, we have asked for 6 years, two election cycles until 2030. We do not do any trial or project in New Zealand. And this is so that we can observe for an extended period of time how this technology, how it might impact civil, constitutional and human rights. The second one is that the RBNZ is not guaranteed authority to issue CBDCs at all until 2030. And that approval must then be taken by a parliamentary vote or by a public vote. The third is that the government agencies equally accept traditional identification, passports and driver's license in parallel with digital IDs. The fourth one is that the broad powers held by the Department of Internal Affairs, as they have the oversight of digital IDs, requires some examination in the context of information sharing agreements between government agencies and the potential for digital IDs and CBDCs to be deployed. So I think, you know, we've said that, you know, so I tend to echo Michael Riddell's, I just can't see that there is a place for CBDCs at all.
Okay, well, we've run out of time, so we'll leave it there. This story is ongoing, so I'm sure we're going to talk again in the future. Thank you again, Jodie Brunning, for your time and your thoughts.
Thanks, Alistair.
That's Jodie Brunning from Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility speaking to us about her paper, which calls for a 6-year moratorium on CBDCs in New Zealand, while we witness what happens to other CBDC programs around the world. And you can read that paper at the Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility website at www.psgr.org.nz. That's PSGR for Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility.org.nz. Or you can also search for them on Substack at PSGRNZ. But that's all that we have time for today in our digital future and our deep dive into the subject of CBDCs. And also, as Jodie pointed out, the associated subject of digital IDs. In the coming weeks, we're going to spread the net wide and bring you interviews from experts all over the world, and also people who have lived experience dealing with both CBDCs and the digital IDs that are tied to them, to talk about the issues of privacy, programmability, global unified ledgers, and all the other plus points and pitfalls of those digital technologies, so that by July 26, when the submissions period for the New Zealand Reserve Bank's public consultation process ends, you'll be able to have your voice heard as well. Do we want a CBDC in this country? And what's the value of the money we already hold as cash in our wallets and purses? Stay tuned to find out. My name's Alistair Harding, and you've been listening to Our Digital Future only on Reality Check Radio.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.